This program may contain explicit language. Also, we have a newsletter coming out. It's at slate.com/gistnews. Now on with the possibly filthy show. It's Wednesday, April 24th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. I will now allow you into my mind in the morning, what's going through my noggin. Here we go, coffee, gotta get coffee. I don't know, where'd you leave your shoes last night? So it's a good place to start. Guys, did you close the closet? You know Layla pees in there sometimes. All right, kiss Michelle goodbye. Now, for the record, I want you to know Layla's the cat, Michelle's the girlfriend. But cutting through all this internal dialogue can be heard in my head these words emanating from my smart speaker.
Here's the big question about Joe Biden.
That is Anna Palmer, who does the Politico morning briefing each morning. She was on The Gist last week, and yesterday she was previewing Joe Biden's entry into the presidential race. We're expecting it tomorrow. Anna laid out two competing theories.
One, Twitter isn't real life, and the former VP is more popular among the Democratic voting rank and file than the Acela corridor conversation would suggest.
That is no doubt true. And if all that's necessary for Biden to be the Democratic nominee is for that to be true, then Biden will be the Democratic nominee. But since I doubt Biden will be the Democratic nominee, let us now step into number two.
Two, Biden's station at the top of the polls simply reflects his name ID. And once primary voters get a look at the 76-year-old bipartisan touting gaffe-prone Washington insider, they'll dart in the other direction.
Well, I think this will probably happen, too. I don't know about dart. I think there's not a whole lot of reason to think that Biden actually stumping for votes as a candidate is going to get many, many votes. Biden, guy who represents the idea of Joe Biden as president, that is appealing. Biden making a speech and convincing you that he doesn't have a lot of flaws, that is perhaps a little less appealing. All right. Let us now hear, as I did, as I was listening the other day, to Anna's co-host Jake Sherman, who was commenting on his colleague's suggestion that familiarity might be overrated.
The weakness of the second argument is that name ID is a potent weapon, especially in a field filled with unknowns. But as many Democrats say to us privately, in a party shifting leftward and skewing younger, why would Democrats want an old guy who talks about how great he is working with Republicans and has a record that is much more moderate than where the base is right now?
I'll tell you why. Part one is why the leftwardness of the base is truly overrated. Every once in a while, we get an empirical data point that confirms this. And we know that, the actual Democratic voters, not as left-leaning as they seem. And yet, as a contradiction to this data point that was fleshed out via research and knowledge, as a contradiction is a never-ending stream of tweets indicating that the Democratic Party absolutely demands that felons currently serving in jail need to vote yesterday. Democrats in general are not as radical as they seem online. They're not as desperate for an impeachment fight as they seem in Twitter. They aren't as for reparations as your Facebook feed may have you believe. And their number one priority isn't unpacking and interrogating privilege and appropriation. It just isn't. Now, this doesn't necessarily argue specifically for Joe Biden. It does argue for a candidate who is leftish, but not a total lefty. Now, I'll acknowledge the left-right thing is not as salient as it once was, but backing crazy-seeming costly proposals that already poll as unpopular, it's just not an optimal strategy for a Democrat. And still, you've got almost every senator trying to out-Bernie-Bernie, thus the rise of Buttigieg, thus the case for Klobuchar, such as it is, thus the only logical explanation for the Seth Moulton supposition. The party isn't as left as social media and all media would have you believe, but it is going to be a walk through left-originating fire to get to the place of nomination. I don't think Biden's going to be the one who comes through uncharred. History tells us he is not the best campaigner, that he is not the most disciplined. You know how we're always hearing that this is the third time he's run for president? It's actually his second, technically. For the 1988 election, Biden actually withdrew in 1987 before anyone in America ever got to vote. He was exposed as a plagiarist, And he wasn't exactly a brilliant and disciplined campaigner. I mean, in New Hampshire in 1987, he was questioned by a guy named Frank this one time, and he didn't take it well.
Senator, I have one real quick question. What law school did you attend, and where did you place in that class? And the other question is, could you quickly... I think I probably have
a much higher IQ than you do, I suspect. I went to law school on a full academic scholarship, the only one in my class to have a full academic scholarship. In the first year in law school, I decided I didn't want to be in law school and ended up in the bottom two-thirds of my class, and then decided I wanted to stay, went back to law school, and in fact ended up in the top half of my class. I won the international moot court competition. I was the outstanding student in the political science department at the end of my year. I graduated with 3 degrees from undergraduate school and 165 credits, only need 123 credits, and I'd be delighted to sit down and compare my IQ to yours if you'd like, Frank.
Here are the actual facts. Joe Biden graduated 76th in his law school class of 85, and records released indicated he had a partial needs-based scholarship. That, by the way, that was an amazing C-SPAN tape to review, and maybe someday I will come back to it. He positions himself as the heartfelt candidate because everyone else is a technocrat. This time out, he'll have to position himself as the realist with experience amongst a group of wild-eyed dreamers. Will it play? We will have a few months to find out, and I guess a lot of it depends on if Frank has any more upsetting questions. On the show today, a spiel from The Vault about a guy who spent his last few months in an L.A. jail cell in the documentary that helped put him there. But first, you might not be a huge NBA fan, but I do want to talk a little bit about the Golden State Warriors because I think they're fascinating. I think they transcend basketball, and not just because they're so, so good. Oh, they're so good. They dominate their field like few other entities dominate their fields. They're the favorite to win an NBA title by a lot. Like, if you want to win $100 on the Milwaukee Bucks to win the title and they're the second favorite, you would have to bet less than $20 to win $100. But to win $100 on the Warriors, you would have to put up $150. So the Warriors are, again, the greatest collection of all-stars the NBA has ever seen, pretty much. And the fascinating thing is they're not happy. They're dysfunctional. They're brilliant, but not enjoying it all that much. Ethan Sherwood Strauss covers the Warriors. He joins me next to put these very large men on a very long couch. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay the neighbor and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust or perhaps we quell. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. With the playoffs upon us, the NBA playoffs, that is, the Golden State Warriors have gone over the last few years from the greatest celebration of aesthetic transcendence to a bit of a bummer wrapped in a slog, surrounded by a foregone conclusion expressed in a whine, and not the kind of whine that comes just north of Oakland. What's with the Warriors? Still a great team, but not a great vibe. I'm joined now by, I think, the man who's the most expert in the Golden State Warriors, Ethan Sherwood Strauss. He hosts the House of Strauss podcasts and writes for The Athletic and sometimes gets yelled at by individual Warriors, but sometimes greatly complimented. Hey, Ethan, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I don't know if I can take the mantle of greatest expert on the Warriors. I know our Tim Kawakami at The Athletic and Marcus Thompson would have something to say about that. But, you know, I do provide the kind of insight that gets me yelled at. You are correct about that.
You are the greatest expert on the Warriors who happened to write a chapter for my book upon further review. So that makes you the greatest expert on the Warriors. So here we go, and here's where I want to have this conversation. Let's talk as little as we can. You know what? Bring it up. I won't suppress you. If you need to talk about back cuts or offensive flow, do so. But I want to talk about personalities. I want to talk about entertainment. And I want to talk about group dynamics. And the first thing that strikes me is that the Warriors are so interesting because they haven't in any way become a worse basketball team. They in many ways have, they're the best. They have the best record in at least the West. They seem like the favorites to win the championship, and yet they've become something far different than what they used to be. They've become so much less joyous. Why?
I mean, this might get a little too deep right off the bat. I wasn't expecting to get so existential so quickly, Mike.
Yeah.
I often wonder if winning is a kind of a lie. Pat Riley coined the disease of more, also referred to as the disease of me, that befalls championship teams, that ultimately pulls them apart, where people start wanting more credit and they wonder why they didn't get more credit. And he says that that's when the real tension arises. And that's what you really have to worry about, is after winning, not before. And I was thinking about that, and I think that's true.
It reminds me of an economist would talk about the marginal value of money. And so $1 million to you or me is a lot, but to Jeff Bezos, it's not a lot. It becomes much less once you've earned a lot. I think that's exactly what Riley's saying.
I think that there's something to that exactly. I mean, the difference between winning zero championships and winning a championship is a huge difference. That's a huge difference to the people who try to win championships. But is the difference between winning four championships and five championships, is that big a deal? You know, it's not really, relatively. I'm sure they're all enjoyable. I remember Steph Curry, after winning the last one, said they're all great. They're all great, when he was asked about the meaning of the most recent one. But they're not all the same level of great. And I do wonder if the Warriors suffer from a bit of, shall we call it, winner's ennui, and they have such an advantage, they have a decadent advantage in terms of talent, that there isn't a lot of credit if they win. There's not a lot of surprise. And so I'm trying to remember what the formula is, that your happiness is reality divided by expectations. Maybe I reversed those. I was never so great at math, but
I think that might be tragedy the inverse, 1/tragedy.
Something. There's a cosine somewhere, right, and right. In the end, Steph's birthday is on Pi Day, March 14th. But I think there's something to all of that, where it creates a bit of a grind atmosphere. And yeah, Kevin Durant's a bit of a moody guy, but they might have fallen into this particular ennui, whether they got him or whether they didn't.
Right. So Kevin Durant, the injection of, you know, the second or third best player in the game to the best team, makes them seem unbeatable. And guess what? They are. And that might be a specific type of curse, because the Boston Celtics won, you know, 11 championships or 12 in 11 years. And the New England Patriots keep winning championships. Football is a different game. Maybe they look at it differently. But I wonder if there's something about, we and this band of brothers keep winning. You add someone so prominent, it's a different group of people that are winning. And that changes things fundamentally. Not that Durant is worse, just so fundamentally different.
Yeah, and basketball is a little different. It's a little more predictable. And even if we think the Patriots might be the team with the best chance, there's still this element when they win of, how are they doing this? How are they doing this? This is incredible that they're pulling this off. Basketball isn't like that. And to what you're saying about adding Durant to the dynamic, it seems as though there was some fondness for the Warriors team that preceded him, and it was a little bit more of the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And it doesn't feel that way with Durant. It just feels, well, their parts add up to more than the other team's parts. And he's a very individualistic player. He's a great individualistic player. He might be the best player, but he doesn't tend to play within a team concept. And they seem to use him as almost a cheat code. And unlike the way people would talk about Steph Curry as a cheat code, who would delight you by bombing from 30 feet away, the Durant cheat code is get a switch, for those who aren't basketball savvy, basically set up a situation where Kevin Durant is dribbling against a smaller player and shoot a turnaround jump shot that nobody can block because he's very tall. And that's just not as exciting to people.
Right.
And it's reflected, I believe, in the ratings. The NBA's ratings post KD coming to the Warriors, not so great.
Right. I've always said that the things that thrill us the most, if I pulled my grandmother or my five-year-old in front of a screen and said, look at that, mostly we'd find amazing and delight in things flying through the air for a long time.
Yeah.
So Michael Jordan cuts through all cultures, and you go, how can a human do that? And the second closest analog, this is why a home run's the most exciting play in baseball, or a huge sliding catch. Those are actually the only two exciting plays.
I'll counter you, because Ramon Laureano, A's center fielder out here, is delighting people by throwing guys out from center field. I would put
that is true.
A guy thrown out of the plate from 300 feet away. Again, it's the thing flying through the air that delights
us. Right. You're right. I'll add that and the long bomb in football. I mean, I don't think that most other plays in sports are that transcendent and that human. And in basketball, it was Steph Curry shooting from a longer distance than you would think a human being could shoot, or shooting from a very long distance while being guarded in a way that you would think prevent him from making a shot. So what we've laid out is that on an aesthetic level, or maybe an entertaining level, just watching a random regular season Warriors game this year isn't as good as the year where they set the record for most wins but actually didn't win a championship or any of their other championship seasons. But what if they were really internally happy? What if they were getting along? What if we wrote the book on what ifs? What if KD and Steph were going out on the town and you know, brothers in arms? Or is there something? So answer that. Or maybe the answer is they couldn't be, just because of the thing we talked about first, how their game has changed. They're not going to be happy.
Well, as Paul Silas once said, NBA ain't no bowl of roses. NBA teams tend to be a little bit miserable behind the scenes, some more than others. There are degrees. So we enjoy watching people who enjoy themselves. And it seems in the NBA right now, there isn't as much interest. Ratings are down. Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA himself, admitted at the Sloan conference, the analytics conference, that all of his stars are miserable. He said that. I was shocked by his candor in saying that. And there's something happening right now where there isn't that band of brothers mentality. And the fans, I do think, are picking up on it. I think the fans are seeing that these players view these teams as vessels by which to expand their brands. And that is a different way of viewing things. It is understandable. It is a reaction to the incentives, of course. But it ain't what fans want to see. Fans want to see something different.
Right. And every once in a while, like feet from where I'm speaking, the Brooklyn Nets actually seem to like playing with each other. They're not the best team in basketball, but everything about them is pretty joyous. And it's a great time to be a Brooklyn Nets fan.
Oh, yeah. And they're exceeding expectations and they're playing unselfishly. And the league got caught up in a little bit of an issue, I think, where, and this is just a bigger cultural question of how much does Twitter matter and how much does social media engagement matter? Because the league became the league of Twitter and NBA Twitter, and Jack Dorsey shows up to Oracle Arena all the time and talks about NBA Twitter. And it turns out that a lot of these social media platforms make you miserable. You know, maybe it's not shocking that the league of Twitter is producing miserable stars who are just charting how their reputation is getting bandied about on these mediums as people argue about them. And maybe the focus isn't where it should be. And also, you know, okay, so there's this issue where sometimes what's talked about and what's juicy isn't necessarily what's making the average fan endeared to your league or want to watch the league. And so this Lakers situation, for instance, is a situation that people will want to read about a whole lot more than they would the Brooklyn Nets. Even the Brooklyn Nets enjoyed each other and had a great time. But I don't know how the league makes money off that. I don't know how the league makes money off the misery of the Lakers and LeBron being depressed. It's a topic. It's going to be discussed on First Take. I just don't understand how that's good for the NBA writ large.
Yeah. I think that a few things may be going on. So, yeah, it is better that players have agency literally and figuratively and aren't under the thumb of owners and the era of the old sports writer who could just rail and rail about players not being
divas.
Yeah, divas and out of touch, and, you know, these guys, the implication that they're all just, you know, some crime waiting to happen. I mean, it was really oppressive. So now players have more agency. We've swung in the other direction. Most of that's to the good, but it also comes at great costs. And then add to it, you know, they are millionaires and multimillionaires playing a sport, but they're also millennials. And like you say, too much exposure to social media is probably not good. And when you pick up on, a lot of these kids are young and maybe have, like, even in some ways more mature than a 25-year-old, in some ways less. When you pick up on what they do as outlets or how well-rounded their lives are, I mean, a lot of them travel on the road with a PlayStation, you know, and don't do much getting out of the hotel.
No, they become people after they retire. That's how it goes with players. It's hard to be a person in that environment on that particular roller coaster ride with everything that's done for you. NBA teams do everything for players because they want them to be focusing only on their job and basketball, and somebody's getting your socks, and somebody's getting your this, and somebody's getting your that. It's a surreal place to exist within, and I think it sometimes might alienate them from the fans in a way. Like you said, we shouldn't be ripping these players in this way and calling them names and, you know, insinuating ugly things about how they're, you know, criminals or the excesses of the sports writing of yore. But the focus should at least be a little bit on fans and whether the dynamics currently are serving fans, because that is what keeps the league going. And that is the majority of my customers, for instance. I have to think about the fans. And there was a funny moment where Kyrie Irving was mocking a writer for asking a question. And I don't know the particulars of that situation, but he sort of mocked him when the writer said he was writing for the fans. Oh, the fans? As though it was the most ridiculous thing in the world that one would think about them. You know, these peasants. Who thinks about them? Feh.
These interlopers.
Yes, yeah, these yeah, exactly. And so, you know, Adam Silver, he was the commissioner of player power, and that's all well and good, but I think he needs to figure out how to marry incentives to make the players happy and the fans happy. And that should be the goal. It's tricky, but that should be the goal.
Well, Kyrie Irving was mocking a reporter. And of course, Kevin Durant called you out by name in a statement in a press conference that I picked up by TMZ is probably the statement that defines Kevin Durant's season. How'd that make you feel? I mean, it extended your brand, didn't it?
Yeah, it's uncomfortable, though. I got a little bit of insight. I'm writing this in my book right now. I got a little bit of insight into just the maddening, acid-laced fishbowl that these guys must exist within, because there's a particular kind of madness to seeing people on television debate your reputation and whether you're good at your job. And it's really inescapable. Right. I mean, I tell the story that I woke up the next day and I didn't really want to look at social media. I didn't want to see the inundation, so I just didn't even do that. But you can't avoid it because people you know start texting you clips and start telling you things and start saying, oh, Dan Patrick said something good about you. And then I watch and I go, oh, yes, Dan Patrick. Yes, you're great. Love Dan Patrick. Love 90 Sports Center. Amazing. And somebody goes, Tracy McGrady was saying bad things about you. And then I go like, ah, boo. That's why you never got out of the first round. Boo, Tracy McGrady. And then you start doing this and you feel yourself getting unhappy and rising and falling with what these strangers are saying about you in these conversations you can't partake in. And at a certain point, I had to just detach completely because it is the road to madness. And you can see how if you did not have enough ballast in your life, if you didn't have, I mean, I'm fortunate enough to have a wonderful wife and a new baby. If I didn't have those things, I think it can be very psychologically damaging to fall into those cycles as these superstars fall into. So to answer your question, it was a little uncomfortable. I didn't totally enjoy it. It comes with the territory, so nobody should feel sorry for me. And ultimately, I think it was somewhat edifying.
Right. Now, I got to say, since I root for Ethan over KD, and I like KD, by the way, and I don't think he's a bad guy at all, and I've loved his long conversations with Bill Simmons, where you get a different side of him than maybe you do at courtside or post-game press conferences. But did any of the Warriors say, either explicitly or just with a little nudge, like, it's okay, it's cool, we understand, you're still okay with us?
They didn't even need to do that. I think there's this fallacy because some fans might think that players – I mean, this is the other thing with the NBA, that these guys wear the same jersey and then they high-five each other when the ball goes through the basket, that fans assume a level of brotherhood that largely isn't there. I mean, it's there in a certain level. You know, I think that they have a certain camaraderie, but they mostly care about themselves and their own brand and what's being said about them. The reaction among the players in the locker room was mostly one of, this is a monotonous season and it's hilarious that this happened, that this is fodder. That, you know, I walked into the locker room and Andre Iguodala pointed at me. He's like, oh, he went off on your ass. And, you know, we started talking about it. And, you know, I think Marcus Thompson, the podcast, was saying that the way the players handled it was actually quite hilarious. And so there isn't much, oh, my God, I'm sticking up for Kevin. I think that there's more of well, that's hilarious. So whatever's happening is hilarious.
Ethan Strauss is a writer for The Athletic. He has the great House of Strauss podcast. He is the author of, well, he wrote a chapter on the Warriors traveling through time for Upon Further Review, the greatest what-ifs in sports history. And he's coming out with a new book on the Warriors, and it's about dynasties, narcissism, and maybe a little bit of switching on the pick and roll. Thanks so much, Ethan.
Thanks for having me. This is great, Mike.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. The trial of Robert Durst, millionaire real estate heir and really weird guy, will begin in Los Angeles in a few months. If you know about Durst, you do so because A, he has been in and out of the news for many years with his name attached to a number of, shall we say, somewhat curious disappearances of women that he knew over the years. But the most likely reason you know Robert Durst is because you saw the HBO documentary The Jinx, which came out in 2015. It was a fairly damaging look at its subject. But yesterday in court, it emerged that perhaps the most damaging scene, which was the last one, was edited in a significant way. Perhaps you remember Durst talking to himself, and the filmmakers had him wired up, and he said, "What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course." And he did say those words. He just didn't say those words next to each other, and he didn't even say them all in that order. Huh. This is shocking. But if you're a listener of The Gist, or if you were 1,009 episodes ago, you know that I found the filmmakers fishy for a number of reasons. So I want to present this one to you, this one from the vault. It's me from March 17th, 2015, talking about The Jinx. Robert Durst probably killed those people. Well, one, we know he killed. He admitted it. He claimed self-defense. The jury agreed. but they never found his first wife, and he has just been charged in the murder of his friend, Susan Berman. Without the film The Jinx, which aired on HBO and advertised on this show, it should be noted, Robert Durst would be walking around today. Without The Jinx, this murderer, in my opinion, which my opinion was informed by the film, but this murderer would not be getting the justice that he deserves. So how then can The Jinx and the filmmakers Andrew Jarecki and Mark Smerling be faulted if without them there would be no evidence at all? But I believe the filmmakers did behave less than ethically. They sat on evidence to maximize the wow at the expense of the now. Here's a rule of thumb about a work of nonfiction. If I tell you a quite salient fact about a reported story, and that fact makes you say, huh, if I had known that, I would have thought about things much differently. Well, then the fact I just mentioned to you should have been in the original reported work to begin with. Here is that fact. The last scene in The Jinx, last scene in the entire series, that climactic interview in which the main subject of three possible murders appears to have confessed, that scene took place in 2012. And that confession, where he's saying, what did I do? Kill them all, of course.
Kill them all, of course.
That confession, the filmmaker's claim, wasn't found until many months later. Uh-huh. Well, why does it matter? Well, Jarecki and Smerling told the best story they could tell. I'll give them that. On the other hand, I don't think they took the most ethical action they could have taken, going to investigators sooner, because that would have undercut the impact of their story. Other filmmakers have made opposite choices. The director of Paradise Lost, Joe Berlinger, explained to the Huffington Post Live why he immediately turned over a bloody knife to police rather than holding it back for maximum impact.
We were given a bloody knife that quite possibly could have been a murder weapon. It was a knife that had blood buried in the hinge. It was a serrated knife that was consistent potentially with the knife wounds on these children. We called HBO and HBO sent us back up to New York, and we all sat down and we, you know, rather quickly decided that, you know, good citizenship is more important than whatever the filmmaking project is. And we actually turned in that knife to the prosecution thinking that this was going to be the death knell of our film project, because trust, somehow miraculously we navigated those waters and still were able to make the film. And in fact, that knife incident is part of Paradise Lost. But we decided back in 93, you know, good citizenship is the most important thing. Mm. You know, good stewardship of the responsibility given to you.
Jarecki and Smerling decided differently. Great documentary. Well, greatly entertaining documentary. And entertaining documentaries have been Jarecki's stock in trade. In Jarecki's Oscar-nominated debut, Capturing the Freedmans, he parceled out his evidence in a way to maximize impact, and I thought at times his choices were questionable. Jarecki framed that 2003 film as a meditation on the difficulty of knowing the truth, but off-screen, he became a full-throated defender of one of the film's subjects who was convicted of molesting children. The Nassau County District Attorney last year issued a thorough reinvestigation of the case, and the resulting report serves as a forceful rebuttal to the techniques and conclusions of Capturing the Freedmans. Lest you think this was just the government refusing to admit it made a mistake, a panel of outside experts, including the president of the ACLU and Barry Scheck, director of the Innocence Project, signed on to the DA's findings, essentially saying there is no reason to think that the convicted child molester, who Andrew Jarecki champions, no reason to think that he didn't do it. In Catfish, Jarecki's second film, he was the producer of that documentary, questions were raised about timeline and authenticity. I've watched that film several times, and I believe certain scenes were faked. Perhaps the entire story was of a too-good-to-be-true quality. Perhaps it started off as real and then became something else and began to be pursued as an allegory or a meditation. I don't think that exactly happened in The Jinx, but in both, ethical questions abound. Not the same questions as in Catfish or Capturing the Freedmans, but entertainment does trump pure presentation of fact in all of these films. Timelines are compressed, complicating details elided. The Jinx did ensnare a man I believe to be a murderer. You can also conclude that Durst could have been arrested 2 years ago based on what's in the movie. You could further argue that it's not the filmmaker's job to assist law enforcement. You could argue all of these things, and people are, which is one of the indications that Jarecki has once more achieved his goal to make a work that is compelling above all else. And that is it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader and Andrea Salenzi. She edited that Jinx segment. And now here's Andrea back with a jingle about shady documentarians who won't withstand legal and journalistic scrutiny. Okay, she's not really here. TJ Raphael is senior producer of Slate Podcast. She notes that if the Golden State Warriors naming convention were to be held throughout the league, we would see a second round matchup between the Bay State Celtics and the Badger State Bucks. The Gist. Please also listen to my other podcast about the Beehive State Jazz. It's Jazz Buzz. You'll love it. Jazz Buzz. Import Dapuru Duperu, and thanks for listening.